Yeah, and I think what we have to do is to begin with the strength of our message. We go to our content and decide what it is that is really the strongest feature of what we have to offer. Right? What's the strength of what we have to offer? Is it reliability? Is it price? Is it comfort? Is it stability? Is it durability? What is it? Right? Then we go to the moment before we deliver that message and bring people's attention to that concept, whatever it is, right? That will make them receptive to the strength of our message.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Imagine if you could get some of the best insights from podcast guests on creativity, productivity, and what it takes to make your work unmistakable. Well, if you haven't picked it up yet, that's exactly what I did with my last book, Unmistakable: Why Only Is Better Than Best. I put together all of the best insights combined with some of my own thoughts on what it takes to create work that's unmistakable. It might make a perfect stocking stuffer, and it might just inspire you to start that creative project you've been thinking about. And as always, today's episode is sponsored by our friends at HostGator. So if you've been thinking about this creative project, now is actually a really good time to start since we're right around the corner from the end of the year. And if nothing else, just buy a domain name. The thing that I've found often is when you don't know what the next steps are, sometimes it's taking the first steps that reveals the rest. And our friends at HostGator are awesome for helping you get started because they have 24/7 live support via phone chat and email, a super easy to use website builder if you're not tech savvy, and if you hate your current hosting provider and you want to switch, they make it easy and free. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Bob, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Well, thanks, Srivi. I am looking forward to the opportunity to interact with you and your followers.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, a lot of people in our audience are probably already familiar with your earlier work because, for those of you listening, if you've read the book Influenced by Robert Cialdini, that's who Bob happens to be. So I want to start with a question that I thought has been really interesting to hear people's answers, and especially you, given what you do and what you've studied around the areas of social influence. I'm curious, what social group were you a part of in high school? And how did that impact some of the choices that you've made with your life and your career and your interest in this whole area of social influence?
Yeah, it's an interesting question in that it was, if you remember back in high school, we used to talk about Venn diagrams, these overlapping circles that had a sweet spot in between the overlaps. For me, I was both an academic, I had academic interests that put me in certain kinds of classes. I was also an athlete of sorts. I played football and baseball. And those individuals who shared those two kinds of interests for me, being in the science club, number one, but also on the baseball team, those were the kinds of kids I hung out with and kind of shaped my identity.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the earlier communication lessons that you learned from each one of those groups that you ended up applying to your work going forward?
Well, you know, there was another set of groups that really started getting me thinking about the influence process. And it has to do with the fact that I was born into an entirely Italian family in a predominantly Polish neighborhood of a historically German city, Milwaukee, in an otherwise rural state of Wisconsin. And whenever I moved from one to another of those settings and the people who populated those settings, the rules changed as to what the norms were for interacting and communicating with one another effectively. Especially, I thought, when I moved from an urban to a rural environment, it wasn't difficult at all to just drive for a few miles and suddenly be in a rural area of Wisconsin where people were selling apples by the side of the road. And if I ever stopped to do an exchange, an economic exchange with someone in that setting, the norms were decidedly different from what I would experience in a city or a supermarket, that sort of thing. So I recognized that, oh, it's not just the content of what you're interested in. It's the context in which an influence attempt occurs that can make a big difference in how it works.
So walk me through how you go from sort of this upbringing where, you know, you're part of multiple social groups to ending up doing the work that you do around this, like writing Influence, which I know came out years ago. I mean, what's been sort of the trajectory of your career that has led to this point?
Well, you know, I think my trajectory started out very traditionally. I went to graduate school, I got a PhD, I got a first job, I started researching the science of persuasion in my laboratory, for the most part using psychology students as the subjects. But then I recognized that by staying located on my campus and using a sample of college students, I was missing something important about the research or the questions that I was studying. And that is, how powerful are these factors that I'm studying, not in the laboratory settings, but in the real world settings that I wanted to apply them to? And that made me recognize that, why do I have to go through the middleman here? Why don't I just go into the settings of interest and see what works there? And so I began to change my orientation, to move from studying persuasion in the laboratory to studying how it worked outside of the laboratory in door-to-door campaigns for charity, in various kinds of situations where people were exposed to a piece of information about what others like them were doing and how that affected their choices in that setting in which they were operating in the moment. Mm-hmm.
So what exactly planted the seed for this book? I mean, I know it's been 20 years since the last one, or even longer. So what prompted your interest and what planted the seed for Persuasion?
Well, you know, the book Influence was devoted mostly to an analysis of what a communicator can put into a message to increase its persuasive success. What factors can be incorporated into a communication that will incline recipients of that communication toward assent. Right? And what the new book focuses on is what a communicator can do, not in the message itself, but in the moment before delivering the message, to increase its persuasive success. Mm-hmm. And the set of factors that moved me from the original model of social influence that says you have to arrange the content of your message correctly to get people to say yes to it, which I still believe, right? But there was a new model as well that I started seeing evidence of that caused me to see this alternative way of creating change. And that was to essentially create a mindset in the recipient of a message that would be consistent with the message that hadn't even been encountered yet. But if it would be possible to put someone in a frame of mind that made that person attuned to the strengths of our subsequent message, that would produce genuine traction. That would give us genuine leverage when the message eventually did occur. Mm-hmm. And I started seeing research that was consistent with this idea. A great example has to do with a study I talk about in the book Persuasion fairly early on. It had to do with a study that was done by an online furniture store. For half of the visitors to the their site, they sent these visitors to a landing page that had as its background fluffy, soft clouds. The other half of the visitors were sent to a landing page that had as its background coins, actually pennies. Right? Yeah. What they found was remarkable. Those people who first encountered clouds then rated comfort as a more important factor in choosing furniture. They also searched the site in a specific way for comfort-related features, and they ultimately chose to prefer comfortable furniture for purchase. Those who were sent to the website with coins rated cost as a more important factor for making a decision about furniture. They searched the site for price-related information and ultimately preferred to purchase inexpensive furniture. So what they saw first changed the way they valued the subsequent material. Well, that wasn't involved in my earlier model of how behavior occurs, how behavior is changed. Mm-hmm. And that got me thinking differently about the moment before we send our content-based message and how to arrange that for optimal success. Mm. Then there was a personal experience I had that made me say to myself, oh, I have to write a book about this. There was a knock at my door. I opened it to find a guy, a middle-aged man, asking me to contribute to a cause I had never heard of. It was for a specific kind of after-school program for children whose parents were working, and the kids needed some activity that would be beneficial for them until their parents could come and pick them up. Well, he didn't show me any credentials that he was associated with this program, and I didn't know anything about it, but I wound up giving him more money than I give to legitimate charity organizations that I know about. And I remember closing the door and thinking to myself, what just happened there? And I realized that the reason I gave him that amount of money didn't have anything to do with the content of his message. It had to do with how he arranged the moment before he delivered the content. And that is, he brought along with him his 7-year-old daughter. And that's what I saw first. And I became attuned to children and children's issues. And just like those subjects in the clouds or coins experiment, I now valued children's issues higher than before, saw them as important, and then acted in a way that was consistent with this new view of the priority associated with children's issues.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Design Crowd. So maybe the whole idea of design intimidates you, but it doesn't have to, because that's where a service like Design Crowd comes in, because they make the equivalent of an entire creative team accessible to you at a price that's incredibly affordable. In fact, if you go to designcrowd.com/creative, you can actually see what other unmistakable creative listeners have had made. They've had business cards made, logos, flyers, all sorts of stuff. Here's how it works. You go to designcrowd.com and you submit your design brief. Then you'll get submissions from anywhere between 60 to 100 designers from around the world. If you like what you get, then you can approve payment, or you can go back to the crowd and ask for more, or ask for your money back. And because you're an unmistakable creative listener, you're getting $100 off your first design project. So visit designcrowd.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for $100 off. Today's episode is also sponsored by our friends at HostGator. So let's say that you've had a website design and you have no idea where to host that website. Well, that's where our friends at HostGator come in. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, an easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy, and if you want to switch hosting providers from the one that you're currently at, they make the whole process free and seamless. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off all of their hosting packages. So I know that you sort of broke this down into six sort of foundational principles for persuasion, which, you know, I happen to have in my notes. Do you mind kind of doing sort of a deep dive into each of these concepts and kind of explaining to us? Let's start with the idea of how do we make people more open to us and to what we're trying to get them to do?
Yeah, and I think what we have to do is to begin with the strength of our message. We go to our content and decide what it is that is really the strongest feature of what we have to offer. Right? What's the strength of what we have to offer? Is it reliability? Is it price? Is it comfort? Is it stability? Is it durability? What is it? Right? Then we go to the moment before we deliver that message and bring people's attention to that concept, whatever it is. Right, that will make them receptive to the strength of our message. Right? They'll be focused on it in a kind of channeled way. Mm-hmm. I got an email from a guy a few weeks ago who had read a copy of Persuasion and said that it caused him to change for the better the approach that he used with his two sons, who were Boy Scouts. When they would go to try to raise money for the Boy Scouts, by going outside of supermarkets, they were allowed to set up a table where they could sell popcorn. Right? So when people came out of the market, they would be asked, would you like to buy some popcorn? And the answer was almost invariably, no thanks. After all, these people had just been in a supermarket. If they wanted popcorn, they could have purchased it in there. Right? No thanks. And then they walked by. So only 15 or 20% of the time did they get a sale. And then this guy who wrote to me said, I rethought, what is the strength of our message? It's not popcorn. It's the Boy Scouts, right? Mm-hmm. So he changed the question to, do you support the Boy Scouts? And almost everyone said yes. And then he said, would you like to buy some popcorn to support the Boy Scouts? And he's now at 80 to 90% compliance.
Wow.
Now, what I liked about this is he said, even those people who don't buy popcorn give us a couple of dollars to support the Boy Scouts. Right? The whole exchange was not about popcorn. Mm-hmm. You have to identify what's your strength first. Then you go to the moment before you offer what you have for sale or trade, right? And bring that strength, the concept associated with that strength, to consciousness in people, that's going to cause them to overvalue, to prioritize that particular feature.
So let's say we're looking at it through the context of something like a Kickstarter campaign or selling a book or something that, you know, some creative person does that they want an audience to pay attention to. How would you approach it there?
Yeah, so I think there, it's a matter of bringing people to the idea of doing something novel or adventurous, right? Mm-hmm. What could you do? What kind of icon could you put in a message? What kind of slogan could you put at the bottom of an email that carried that message? What kind of question could you ask individuals first that brought them to the idea of adventurousness? There's even a study that shows how this could be done. Researchers walked up to individuals on the street and handed them a flyer, right, asking them if they'd be interested in trying out a new brand of soft drink. And if so, they would have to give their email address to the person who handed them the flyer, right? Well, that's kind of a risky thing to do, first of all, to give your email address to a perfect stranger. It also has to do with something about getting some information about how to get something brand new that's unfamiliar, right? So when they asked that question, on that flyer, they just handed the flyer that said, would you be interested in getting this, and here's how you would do it, right? Only 30% of the people gave an email address. That was for one sample of the subjects. But for another sample of the people that they approached, they handed them the same flyer, except at the top was the question, do you consider yourself an adventurous person? And now 55% of them turned in their email address. Right? Nearly doubling the success by simply bringing people's attention to their adventurous side.
Well, let's do this. There's three other concepts that caught my attention that I know you talked about in the beginning of the book that really kind of intrigued me. And these were association triggers, language and imagery, and the geography of influence and environment. I'd love for you to kind of give us an overview of those, because to me, you know, as I got to look at those, I was like, wow, these are tools that not only can be used for, you know, persuasion when we're dealing with, you know, changing other people's behavior, but also to change our own.
Right. So you've mentioned language and imagery. I like imagery because as an old persuasion researcher, one thing that I've recognized is that when you make a verbal or a written argument where you provide an appeal in some sort of a case that you make, right, it's possible for people to counter-argue that. But they never counter-argue images. People simply don't. Right? You take in an image. Right? So that's why that clouds and coin study, I think, was so interesting. And we can do the same thing for ourselves. For example, there was a study done that showed that if people were given an image of a runner winning a race, right, that they were constantly exposed to while they were performing their job, which was to call and get contributions to a particular charity, right, they collected 60% more money than if they didn't have that image, right? There was another study that showed that people who had to perform a difficult complex problem-solving task that required concentration and deliberation and analysis, were 42% more successful if they had an image of Rodin's The Thinker statue available to them while they were performing the task. So whatever image was put into people's minds at the outset of the task steered them in a direction that allowed them to complete the task more successfully. We can do that for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
What is the task that you have? Is it one that involves making a lot of contacts with people, setting up meetings or getting some kind of event arranged that requires a lot of energy and so on? Put a picture of a runner winning a race on your computer screen in the corner. If it is instead figuring a budget, maybe, where you have to think, put a picture of Rodin's Thinker in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's going to steer us in the direction we want. And I'll give you a personal example of what I did in this regard in writing this new book, Persuasion. I first thought of an end game. Right? What did I want at the end of this process of writing this book? I wanted a book that had legs, that is, that didn't just sell for 6 months and then die. I wanted a book that was durable, that made a continuing contribution, right, over the years. Right? So here's what I did. So I have three grandchildren, and I gave their parents each a copy of the book. Right? I knew that I was going to do this before I even started writing. Three copies with notes to each of my grandchildren, right, and a dedication to them. The book was dedicated to my grandkids. Right? And here's the image. When they're old enough to read it, that's probably in 10 or 15 years for the youngest of them.
Mm-hmm.
I want their parents to give them the book and say, your grandfather wrote this book for you. Well, it had better be a good book. It had better stand the test of time so that when my grandkids read it, they liked it. Not just because it was dedicated to them, but because a good book was dedicated to them. That's what kept me in my seat, kept me working, making sure there were no shortcuts in writing this book.
So I'm myself in the middle of writing a book, a second one, and I'm curious. So what my thought was, right, as I heard you say that, was the best thing to do that I could think of was, okay, maybe I can go and find an image as my wallpaper for my background of somebody actually writing. Would that increase the likelihood that I would write?
Yes. In fact, there's research, that study I was telling you about, where people who saw a picture of a runner winning a race became more successful in collecting funds while they were at a call center. Right?
Mm-hmm.
These researchers also did a subsequent study where they showed them pictures of people making calls. Right? And that had the same effect. So anything that brings to mind the operating on the task in a successful way, right, is going to lend itself to the motivation to operate on that task in a successful way.
Mm-hmm. So you know, there's another thing that I thought was really interesting you talked about was this whole idea of self-influence and changing our own behavior, like through that if-then-when framework. And I was curious if you could kind of walk us through that and explain it to us and talk about how that enables us to change our habits.
Yeah, that's a good one. And I'm impressed by the quality of the research that has shown that very often we have goals that we don't reach. And one of the reasons is that we lose our motivation to reach those goals because we often aren't put in mind of the goals as we are going through our life. So, for example, we might have a motive to do more exercise, but we're not even thinking about that when we're at the office, when we're entering the building, and we could take the stairs or we could take the elevator. I mean, we're in our old habits, right? Mm-hmm. Or we're preoccupied. We're thinking about what we have to do when we get to the office, those kinds of things, right? So what if, when, then plans do is tell us to structure the following commitment for ourselves. If, when I am standing in front of the elevator, right, I see the stairs nearby, I will take the stairs then. Right? So you put a cue in your mind that is going to be there that directs you to the action you really want to take. There was a study done, for example, of individuals who were having trouble taking their medication in a timely way. And all the researchers had to do was to create an if, when, then plan as follows. If it's 8 o'clock and I have finished brushing my teeth, then I will remember to take my medication. And that produced a significant increase. I believe it was from 59% to 72% of people who were now compliant with their medication regimen. Mm-hmm. You just have to put the goal in mind in a place that you will be cued to that goal by your commitment to that place and that time.
So, I mean, we've looked at it through the lens of, you know, sort of a smaller goal, for example, hey, I want to exercise. But how do you deal with it in the context of sort of bigger goals that we can't necessarily concretely say, okay, yeah, I know exactly how I'm going to accomplish goals. Let's say, for example, you want to increase your income as your goal. How could this framework be used for something like that? Because it's not nearly as, okay, if, then, when, in terms of being as concrete. So I'm curious how you'd apply it in that context.
Right. I think in that sort of situation, that's too big a goal, right? You've got to limit your goal to something that allows you to increase your income. Like, okay, what I'm going to do when I'm faced with a daunting task is to power myself through it. And the way to do that is when I've got that kind of task, I'm going to put a picture of a runner winning a race in the corner of my screen. Mm-hmm. So you figure out what sub-goal will lead to the larger one, and then you give yourself cues in your environment that will lead you to the sub-goal, to the achievement of that sub-goal.
So one question I wanted to ask you, because I know you talked quite a bit about sort of media and messaging in the book, and I was just kind of curious, you know, given that it is an election, we're talking on the actual election day, what your thoughts are around sort of how do you look at the election through the lens of the work that you've done?
Well, I'll tell you, it's my policy not to talk about elections while they are ongoing, but I'll tell you about something I noticed that the Obama campaigns of 2008 and 2012 did very successfully that was persuasive. They pioneered this strategy of when the candidate was speaking, behind him, Obama, was a sea of faces demographically arranged so that any observer saw themselves behind that candidate. Right? Even before he said a single word, you saw somebody in your category there. There were blondes, there were African-American, there were Asians, there were old individuals, there were younger individuals, there were males, there were females. Whatever demographic category they were interested in making contact with, they were structured back there. And, you know, I always wondered, what are those people doing behind the candidate? They're only seeing the back of his head. Why are they back there? Well, they weren't back there for their purposes. They were back there for the audience's purposes. So they could see themselves represented in supporters of this candidate even before they heard a single word.
So I have two last questions for you. One is, as a speaker, I am curious how, you know, prior to delivering a talk, you may basically get the audience more open to your message, especially when it's not an audience you've had a chance to have any contact with prior.
Yeah. And this is a great question because it involves making a change in myself that makes a change in the audience to be more receptive to me. A few years ago, when I was just starting out as a speaker, I had a friend who said, I've got a buddy who advises speakers on how to improve their presentational skills. And would you like to talk to him? So, yes, I did. And I spent an afternoon with this guy after he watched one of my presentations. And I can tell you, I don't remember anything that he said during those 3 hours, except one thing that has changed what I do dramatically as I walk on a stage. Right? He said, you know, Cialdini, you've got kind of a wide mouth and a big smile. Right? He said, before you go on the stage, find a reason to smile broadly at your audience. What I liked about that advice was that he didn't say, smile broadly at your audience. He didn't say, fake it. He said, find a reason to genuinely smile. People will like that. You will have a reason for being glad to be there. They will register it in your smile, and now you've got receptivity and rapport before you've ever said a word. So I do. That's what I do every time now.
So one other question about this, where do you draw the line ethically with all of this? Because, you know, I feel like you could use this in the wrong, like, where is the line between when it's persuasion and when it's manipulation?
Yeah, that's why I think this is a crucial question that you've asked. I think ethics are just paramount for producing a long-term commercial or business relationship with anyone, and that is, you have to be sure that you treat them in an honest and ethical way. So for me, the difference is, once again, going to the content of what you have to offer and bringing the audience attention to the strength of it, the thing that will make it wisest for them to choose what you are offering them. Not the thing that will produce the biggest profit margin for you. The thing that will make it wise for them to choose. Right? That way, both sides are benefiting, and you get the likelihood that people will want to come back for future opportunities to benefit.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, this has been fantastic. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Unmistakable?
Mm-hmm.
Can you ask unmistakable in terms of how others view him? Or
yeah,
somebody who never makes a mistake?
No, probably the other. But really, it's
yeah,
up to you.
So visible and conspicuous and
yeah.
So on. Yeah. For me, it is scrupulous trustworthiness. I say that because the research that I've seen shows that the single thing people look for in any relationship, either personal or commercial, is trustworthiness. That's the top thing they look for. If you can demonstrate your trustworthiness first, before you send your message, people will be looking at you and looking to you for information that will have you stand out as somebody who is conspicuous by this extremely positive trait.
Well, like I said, this has been fascinating, as I expected it would be. And I really, really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your insights and your story with our listeners.
Well, I enjoyed it, I have to say.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate that. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.